Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we'll be talking to mountain climber Conrad Anker about Mount Everest. And we'll be talking about the play, Six Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks, that's at the Santa Fe Playhouse. And we'll be talking to Professor Avinoam Pat about Jewish Holocaust survivors right after World War II in Europe. I'm very happy now to welcome Nacha Mendez, also known as Margarita Cordero. She is a musician, vocalist, guitar player. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you have a new song, which is released in time for Christmas, which is Your Voice and Cora. First of all, instead of your regular familiar guitar, what is a cora?
A cora is an African stringed instrument, and it's a giant gourd, and it's got a very long neck, and... The gentleman who plays it is a kora master, and he's from Gambia. His name is Fode Musa Suso. And I've never actually gotten my hands on a kora, but I've seen one, and I've seen it in pictures, and I've seen Fode in his photographs. And that's how I met Fode, because he was putting it through luggage at the airport, and he was right in front of me, and I said, what is that? You know, is that a stringed instrument? He goes, yes, it's my kora. So, but I never saw it, but he didn't have a hard shell case for it, and I was like, okay, so he's putting it through there. And I asked him, I said, aren't you afraid it's going to crack and, you know, it's going to come back, you know, crack? He goes, no. He said, I've always traveled with it this way, and it's never been broken, it's never been cracked. And I was like, okay, this man has got angels surrounding him.
Because he and his instrument.
Yeah, and his instrument, yeah. So that's how this whole thing started, with the recording of this song. And it also was partially also inspired by my producer, Steve Peters, who had many years ago suggested I record this song.
And he himself a wonderful musician.
Yes, composer, and doing really well in Seattle now.
Well, why don't we listen to the song first, okay, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Okay.
Here we go.
Pintor nacido en mi tierra, con el pincel extranjero, que sigues el rumbo de tantos pintores viejos, aunque la Virgen sea blanca, pinta mi angelitos negros que también se van al cielo, todos los negritos. Pintar, si pintas con amor, ¿por qué desprecias su color? Si sabes que en el cielo también los quiere Dios. Pintor de santos de Algoba, si tienes alma en el cuerpo, porque al pintar en tus cuadros te olvidaste de los negros, siempre que pintas iglesias, pintas angelitos bellos, pero nunca te acordaste de pintar un ángel negro. Thank you. Si sabes que en el cielo también los quiere Dios. Pintor de santos de Alcoba, si tienes alma en el cuerpo, porque al pintar en tus cuadros te olvidaste de lo negro. Siempre que pintas iglesias, pintas angelitos bellos, pero nunca te acordaste de pintar un ángel negro.
That was Angelitos Negros, Nacho Mendez vocals, and accompanied by this instrument called a cora, played by Fode Musa Suso. Now, what was the production of this like? How did you get together? Was this done in real time, or did you record your voice and the cora separately?
They were done in different studios. When I started corresponding with Fode, I said, I have this idea and I'd like you to play on it. And we had sort of talked about the possibility of having, I was going to have Fode come here to Santa Fe to record with me. And then I just started recording a series of songs in the studio. And while I was there, I said, I'm just going to record piano and guitar and my voice. And then, you know, I kept corresponding, and then it didn't work out. But it turns out that Fode lives in Seattle, where Steve lives. So I asked Steve if that's a possibility. He said, yeah, I can record Fode here, no problem. So what Fode got was the piano version, me singing, and then he put his part on it in Seattle in a studio at the Jack Straw Studios. However, it was a little bit problematic because the tuning is different. The cora is tuned differently than the piano. But it was slightly off, not totally off.
And what kind of adjustments did you have to make? I mean, was it done in production? Or
I think in the studio, Steve took care of that with the tuning. I think they had to tune it to what Fode was listening to in the studio. So that was it. But it was taken care of, and I'm very happy, you know, that it worked.
Yeah, what a kind of strangely beautiful combination.
Yeah, and I, you know, I now have started to work with people that way, where we correspond and we send tracks to each other. They recorded in their studio, I recorded here, and that's how I've been working lately. However, I'm getting ready to record some more songs, and I'm actually going to bringing some local people in on some tracks. So,
now you have been doing music since you were a little girl growing up in southern New Mexico.
Yes. I started out playing guitar, and as soon as I was 5 years old, my parents saw that I just took to the guitar right away, and they bought me, you know, like a five and dime plastic guitar, and that's what I started on. And then they saw, oh yeah, she really likes it. So then they got me a real guitar in Juarez, you know, a classical guitar. Then I started taking lessons.
And so what styles of music were you playing at first?
Well, the songs that my grandmother taught me, and they were rancheras, corridos, boleros, mostly rancheras. She was a singer, and then her name is Nacha Mendez. And that's, I've taken on her name. Before she passed, I asked her if I could use her name. Because she did really teach me my very first songs, how to sing them and how to play them.
And so you were singing and playing all along?
Yes. Yes, it was a great experience.
And then from those very deep roots in the music of Mexico and southern New Mexico, then you took off and started doing all kinds of things.
I did. It was through rock music. It was through rock music that I experimented and found these other styles that I really gravitated toward, like punk. I loved punk music, and then
did you sing punk?
Yes,
punk,
yes,
guitar,
yes,
that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do we have any recordings?
You know, Una, DJ Una might have some recordings of that, because she was in the band that I played it back in the very early 80s. And then avant-garde music. I was always listening to avant-garde, even in high school. I loved electronic music, avant-garde music, new music. Meredith Monk was a major influence. And then I went to study at the College of at New Mexico State University. And I continued, but then I moved to New York. And I tried to do dance club music in New York. And then I came back here, and that's when I met Steve. And then Steve and I started collaborating and doing more like folk avant-garde music.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you've got all these recordings, and then you've got this Cora music that we just heard, and you also play and sing here in Santa Fe on a regular basis.
I do. I mostly solo acoustic at La Boca El Farol, and I play with Melanie Mansour at La Posada, and Melanie and I have been playing for several years, 13 years now. We've recorded two records. But I'm just hooking up now with a new group, and I'm just starting to try to gather people that I want to play with in the coming year, because I have some new material I'd like to just present, and I'm just itching to do that. You know, I really wanted. I did a little bit of tango earlier. I've done salsa. I've done Cuban son. And now I'm thinking more Latin soul, you know, more
Latin
of that.
Latin soul.
Yeah.
What's that?
It's a combination of, well, for me, I it's a combination of Latin music, but have a little bit of a pop influence, but not quite too poppy.
Yeah.
And have some real deep R&B roots as well.
Very interesting. And all those things that are both in the history of our cultural traditions as Americans and yours growing up here in New Mexico, bringing those together. It's interesting. I was in Cuba several years ago in Havana, and there was a new disc that came out that was very popular in which it was kind of a Cuban soul drawing very heavily on American soul traditions, and they didn't quite pull it off.
Wow.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it makes one think about, you know, what you can... It's not just what you love, but it's what you can actually do, what you can pull out of yourself.
Right, right. And I think ultimately that's what it's about, what you bring out of yourself, what you, you know, present and express. Yeah.
So this new material that you're looking forward to, these are your own compositions?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So will you come back and present them to us?
I will. And my next album, it's kind of interesting because it's like... I have my foot in the past, and my other foot is in the future. So the next album is going to be a little bit of songs I never recorded. So it's still from my past. And the new
meaning
song...
Meaning boleros and corridos and stuff?
Yes, and some songs that I worked with Melanie. Songs that we play, but we never recorded. And then the songs, that, the new songs that are coming out.
Now, if people would like to get their hands on this beautiful, deep blue disc single of Angelitos Negros, where can they find it?
They're going to be able to find it on CD Baby in the next couple of days. I just need to sit down and do that and upload everything, but it'll be available on CD Baby.
And you've got four versions of it.
Yes. I think the first one is piano.
Yeah.
Yes, piano, and that's with Melanie. That was the first track that we recorded, me singing, Melanie playing. And then the second one is Fode and Melanie and myself.
Uh-huh.
And then the third is just me.
That must have been the hardest one to tune.
Yes, that was the hard one. And then me and Fode in the third cut. And then there's a bonus track, which is a song that I released in 2004 on my Volando CD. And
I
did that in English, but this one is in Spanish. And Steve always liked this version, and he wanted to put it on there. And I said, okay, you know, I haven't heard it in many years, so yeah, let's do that. So,
yeah. Nacha Mendez, also known as Margarita Cordero, is a musician, guitarist, vocalist. She plays at El Farol. She plays at La Boca, the new CD single. Well, is it called a single when there's four tracks on it?
I know. It is a CD single. I mean,
it's
just one song.
It's one song.
But
okay.
You get, like, I like to call four radio edits. So programmers can decide, pick and choose which one they like best.
Right.
So, yeah.
Anyway, so it's called Angelitos Negros, available at cdbaby.com. And it's just great to have you back on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Conrad Anker. He is a mountain climber, and he is the subject of the new National Geographic film, The Wildest Dream, which opens on Christmas Day at the Screen on the campus of Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's such a fascinating film about Mount Everest, about mountains, about George Mallory, perhaps the first man to summit Mount Everest. This film sort of explores that, but was he the first guy to even get close?
Yeah, in 1920, 21 and 22, and then the last trip was 1924, the English had launched expeditions to climb Mount Everest, and George Mallory was part of all three expeditions, and it was on his final expedition on June 8th, 1924, that he disappeared. And the question's always been, could he have made it to the summit 29 years before Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay didn't?
You also are a very, very serious climber and climbed Mount Everest yourself, and you amazingly found the body of George Mallory.
That's correct, yeah. In 1999, on the north side of Mount Everest, I came across Mallory's body at an elevation about 27,000 feet. It was a very humbling moment.
How did you know it was he?
There was a Chinese climber in 1975 that had come across an English dead, and that news sort of circulated in the climbing circles, and we knew from historical background that it must have been one of the two English climbers from the 1924 expedition, and that was the case, and so it really it was just by chance that I came across his body, and then upon further research, we realized that it was George Mallory.
What were you able to put together about the last hours and minutes of George Mallory's life?
Imagine you're there on the north face of Mount Everest, 28,000 feet. No one's been that high before. Leather boots with little metal spikes, hobnails in them, woolen knickers, belt fedora, a rudimentary oxygen cylinder. And there you are, going to the top of the world. No one has ever been there. But they probably realized that it was a difficult endeavor, and they might have been on their way down, or they could have still been going up, but they turned around, and they were on their way back, and either George or his partner Sandy slipped, pulled the other one off, snapped the rope, and they came to rest at that point forever, the mystery being, could they have made it to the summit of Everest 29 years before Hillary and Norgay did?
Well, there is a clue that indicates that perhaps they did make it to the summit, which is the photograph of Mallory's wife.
Yeah, and when Mallory left, he spoke to his wife, Ruth, that he would take a photograph and he would put it on the summit of Everest. And the photograph was never found, and it could have been left on the summit. It could have been left at his high point. It could have fallen off of his body. So it's not conclusive proof, but it does. It keeps that story of Mallory. It keeps that mystery alive. So it's really important.
We're talking to mountain climber Conrad Anker. Now, you decided to kind of replicate Mallory's journey down to his clothing. And it just, Mallory himself, one wonders what the, I don't want to say mental pathology is, but what does it really take to make you want to go and do such an incredibly dangerous journey where there's a very good chance you'll lose your life? Now, you guys are doing it without the beautiful high-tech clothing and gear, but rather with Mallory's gear.
Yeah, well, we used period clothing as much as we could up to an elevation of about 28,000 feet, and then for the last bit to the summit, we switched into modern gear out of safety and self-preservation. But I think that thread for exploration that Mallory had really carries through all of humanity, whether you're Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon, or Tenzing Norgay and Sir Edmund Hillary on Everest, or anyone doing those things for the first time. There's that need to explore that's very much a part of humanity.
part of the theme of the film is the parallels between your life and Mallory's life. Both of you had wives at home who very much supported what you were doing, but were also terrified while you were doing it.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, that's a good understanding. And my wife, Jennifer, understands what I do, and she knows the risks that are part of it. And she's also is aware that I'm as safe as I possibly can be.
One of the things I was thinking about when watching this film was, there you are climbing up this incredibly crazy mountain. You're going to, 26,000 feet. Not only you and your partner, but a National Geographic film crew is there as well, and they're kind of the invisible heroes doing this journey with you. They must have to be incredible mountaineers themselves.
Yes, and we all worked together. Every day we would plan the next day's shoot, and each camera had a dedicated team of four, so one cameraman and then three to support that cameraman. So the logistics of making this happen are very involved, and as you pointed out, the film would not have worked out had it not been for the excellent team we were able to pull together.
What kind of dangers did you, your partner, and the team face on this climb that you did that replicated Mallory's climb?
In 2007, we climbed the same route that Mallory had pioneered in 1921, and the route's been climbed, so some of that mystery is taken away, but the challenges and the risk are still predominantly the high altitude and the lack of oxygen, and it just slows you down. You can't think as clearly. Your reaction time is slower, and because of that, a simple mistake can cascade into something catastrophic.
Now, Mallory did have oxygen as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. They had a system that was adapted from the pilots that used it in World War I, so it really wasn't what we now use, where it's really advanced, but rather kind of more on the simple end.
When you get to the summit of a mountain like that, is there any life of any kind at all?
There's ravens that fly around up there, so but basically the extreme reaches of altitude, there might be some insects and sort of small things, but you're not going to encounter a bear or a deer or any animal life. Pretty barren.
One of the things that also is striking is that you, like Mallory, both Mallory and his partner died on the mountain, but you and your partner did a climb, and you lost your partner. He died right there with you on a climb.
Yeah, that was with Alex Lowe in 1999. It was a very low point in my life.
What led you to keep climbing after that?
I enjoy being outdoors. The challenge is unique, and the camaraderie and the teamwork that you build from being outdoors with someone in a place like that is really, to me, very special.
So this movie was filmed by National Geographic. I take it some of it was a kind of recreation or reconstruction, for example, finding of the body and things like that.
That's correct. Some of it was done in a studio and then with computer technology woven into the film.
What do you take home from it all? After this documentary was made, after a life of climbing and the risks and real death that are part of this whole life, what does it all mean for you? I mean, the great quotation from Mallory, which has been used by everybody, you know, why do you climb the mountain? Because it's there. What about you, Conrad Anker?
Probably the overarching motivation is to challenge yourself, to enjoy nature and all of its wonder, and then over those two, to live in the moment and to realize that we have one go at life and this is it, and each day needs to be that special day, and each day is that wonderful day. I think Mallory embodied that. He really loved life, and he shared it with his family, and he shared it with his friends. Being able to share this passion for the mountains, adventure, living in the moment, it's a real special treat and something that I've been fortunate to do and that Mallory was doing, and my calling in life, so I've got to live it.
Conrad Anker is a mountain climber, and he's the subject of the new National Geographic film, The Wildest Dream. It opens on Christmas Day at the Screen here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for your time, and happy holidays to you and your friends.
Thank you, and same to you. I'm delighted now to welcome Elena Zachary and David McConnell. They are the stars of the holiday production at the Santa Fe Playhouse, 6 Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a two-person play, something that you, Elena, seem to specialize in. We've had you on the air a couple of times talking about these wonderful two-person plays that are happening around Santa Fe. What's this one about?
Oh, this is a wonderful story. I play Lily Harrison, a Southern Baptist lady living in a condo on the 14th floor, the Gulf Coast of Florida. And I hire Michael Minetti, a.k.a. David McConnell, to come and teach me ballroom dancing. And we are at each other's throats before the door is open.
Why?
Well, partly you have to come to find out why. And, of course, it blossoms into the most wonderful, unlikely relationship. So there's a lot to be said for humor and friendship with ballroom dancing thrown in on the Gulf Coast of Florida.
Tell us about your role, David.
Michael Minetti is an ex-chorus boy from New York. He's living in Florida. He had to just empty his apartment very quickly to care for his mother, who is very sick. And he rushes right down to be with her and to help her out. He finds himself in a situation that he's running out of money. He desperately needs a job. His background is dance, and he signs up with a studio to teach these private lessons for various, I assume, widows in Florida.
And, if I can interject, mm-hmm. I'm his first student.
Ah,
so he's never done it before.
Yes.
And I've never had private lessons before. There's a lot of secrets that get revealed, and I'll tell one early on. When he comes over to teach me, he thinks that my husband, who is a Southern Baptist minister, is still lurking about. We learn early on that she is a widow.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that she gives herself is private dance lessons.
And dance lessons, what kind of dance are we talking about?
Ballroom.
Ballroom, there's all kinds of ballroom.
Ballroom, yeah. We start with a swing.
Is the first
East
one.
Coast swing.
Mm-hmm.
We move into tango. Waltz.
Viennese waltz, foxtrot.
Foxtrot, cha-cha. And then we move into contemporary and cover every contemporary dance that's ever been danced.
And so, of course, the play is rich with music.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Every scene has music and every scene has dancing.
Now, this is a play by Richard Alfieri.
Mm-hmm.
Italian is what it sounds like. And what can you tell us about the playwright?
He's actually won a number of awards, I think, for television film scripts. I guess that would be Emmys. And allegedly, 6 Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks is becoming a major motion picture.
Really?
It's a huge hit as a play because it's humorous, because it's musical, because it's only 2 people and therefore not expensive to produce. And something like 22 countries and 26 languages. If you Google 6 Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks, you see a plethora of posters and productions. It's always being done somewhere in the world. And our very own Dan Garrity had the pleasure of seeing the original cast. It's an awesome Uta Hagen in one of her last roles, and David Hyde Pierce, whom we know from Frasier, mm-hmm. 39 Steps, Spamalot, a brilliant pairing.
And you had to study ballroom dancing, or are you both proficient ballroom dancers? Or
no, I had never ballroom danced before.
Oh, so that's a challenge.
Yeah, it was, and I started a month early on, and we studied at Dance Studio, or Dance Station,
mm-hmm.
excuse me.
Mary Brennecke and
Lawrence Black.
Uh-huh.
Are the choreographers of the show. They're also instructors at Dance Station, which is a gorgeous studio.
Very nice studio,
yeah,
indeed.
Yeah.
Wall of mirrors.
Solano. The Solano Mall
right,
there.
Right.
It's a really pretty place.
And for my childhood, my parents would glamorously go to Miami Beach, and they would do ballroom dancing, and they would come back and study ballroom dancing in our rumpus room with Tony and Yolanda. So I was raised with ballroom dancing and the glamour of that in the late 50s. So that really feeds me as Lily Harrison, that glamour and those dances.
And with the popular now of Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, of course.
The play was written a decade ago, at least, before that popularity came about. But now, with it, people just kind of like ballroom at this point.
Oh, yeah. And people like watching it, and people like doing it. It is so much fun. I mean, my thing is salsa, but whatever kind of partner dancing you do, there's a magic in it.
It's wonderfully magic. And I grew up in a generation that didn't touch your partner while you were dancing, usually, unless you were doing country swing at the line camp or but mainly it was contemporary free form with no touching.
And part of what's fun is the fact that with my background is a lot of Broadway musicals, but it's never ballroom dancing.
Right.
So how much fun is it to be dancing with David, doing these wonderfully romantic, nostalgic, born again dance forms, and the audiences just love it.
And it's the one common ground that these two characters, who are so different in their backgrounds, share this love for the dance. And it's their way to connect, and it's their way to grow with each other. The only common ground they have, basically, is the dance. And it proves magical for the characters.
And there's something to be said for what dance and what scene. I think it's the metaphor of the onion is not lost in this production, because little parts of them get stripped away. Yeah. We get to know deeper and deeper who they are, and it's through the dance and the revelations that create this just gorgeous friendship.
You know, the metaphor of the onion, if I may say as an aside, it's kind of a funny metaphor for seeing people more deeply, because no matter how deep you go, all you have is onion.
Isn't there a tiny little green thing at the center?
Not necessarily.
Oh, I'm so disappointed.
And the more you peel, the more they make you cry.
So why bother?
Father.
Well, there's a little of that in our show as well. Onion, that is.
Would you like to do a little bit of dialogue from it?
Yeah. Want to?
Sure.
You want us to set this up, no doubt.
Yes, okay. Please do.
This is the second scene, and this is the tango lesson. And we always dress appropriately. Each of us dress for the lesson that we're about to have, which is a lot of the fun, and the sets are just divine. So Michael Minetti starts.
The tango is the second scene in the show. We met each other through the East Coast Swing. Becoming popular in World War II, and now I'm going back to the tango, which I'm describing to her.
And he's flamboyantly dressed.
And very flamboyantly
like
dressed.
Like Zorro.
Yes.
And so is she, as a matter of fact, in her way.
And right before this little bit happens, we've had one of our many fights that we have.
Many fights.
And I'm ready to storm out and leave and never come back, and I do, but I'm just kidding.
and this is where we pick up.
Yeah,
you come walking, you come back in.
Yeah, I've left her apartment. She said, "I don't care if you stay or go." And I say, "Well, in that case, I'll go." And then she's about to close the door, and I burst into her and scare her.
Is that where you want to start?
Sure.
Good Lord, really, Michael? You don't do that to an old woman.
Oh, don't get all geriatric on me.
You made me go on about you, made me humble myself.
I didn't make you.
You didn't stop me. It's all a game till you're toying with another soul.
I was not toying with another soul. I was really upset. I just decided to forgive you very, very quickly. I am not capable of holding a grudge.
I am.
Okay, Lily, very Joan Crawford. But it's like dancing. Know when to change the steps. The tango had its origins in Argentina.
Now, just hold it, please. Normal people need transitions between events.
Come on, Lily, tick-tock. You don't want to look back on your deathbed and say, "Damn, I wish I hadn't wasted so much time on transitions." The tango is perhaps the most sensual, romantic of the Latin dances. It was created by the gaucho of Argentina, who, after a hard day on the pampas, got his much-needed R&R by picking up a floozy in the local taberna, getting her sloshed on cheap wine, and then dragging her around the dance floor for a few measures before laying her.
Is this background material standardized for the cause, or do you make it up as you go?
I simply add honesty to it, Lily. The origin of all dancing is sexual.
Elena and they do dance.
And they do,
and they do dance.
I'm hoping so. Elena Zachary and David McConnell, Six Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks, is directed by Larry Lee. It's at the Santa Fe Playhouse, and it's running through the 2nd of January. And this is Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 8 o'clock every night, and Sunday at 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. No shows on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day or New Year's Eve, but other than that, you're running 6 days a week.
It's like a Broadway schedule, minus one matinee. It's
That's true. Crazy.
Yeah. It's fabulous because this is a great time. It's a beautiful holiday show. It's about laughter, and it's about redemption, and it's about dance
lessons.
It's about
friendship, most of all. It really is.
And it's a crowd pleaser, and everybody seems to love it.
It's true.
It's a very touching, poignant, nice piece.
Feel good.
Feel good.
Feel good. We like feel good. Elena Zachary and David McConnell, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm delighted now to welcome Avi Noam Pat. He is professor of modern Jewish history at the Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Hartford. And he will be speaking on Sunday, the 2nd of January, at Congregation Beit Tikva, sponsored by the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society. The talk is titled Jewish Youth and Zionism in the Aftermath of the Holocaust. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you will be talking about the time period in Europe, 3 years between the end of World War II and the founding of Israel in 1948. Here you have a population of Jewish Holocaust survivors, displaced, traumatized. Where did they go? What did they do?
It's interesting because if you look at the period after the war, it's a population that really changes in the first 3 years after the war, really in the first year after the war. So in my book, I look at the situation in Germany immediately after the liberation of the concentration camps there. And there you have, estimates vary, but about 50,000 Jewish Holocaust survivors who are a small percentage of really millions of refugees, displaced persons, and POWs who are in Germany at the end of the war. And from that 50,000 or so who are liberated from Germany, by 1947, you have close to 200,000 Jewish survivors who have congregated in the American occupation zone of Germany, many of them coming from Eastern Europe to Germany. And by 1947, you have this very large stateless population of Jewish displaced persons who really have nowhere to go. The United States still has a restrictive immigration policy. They've decided they don't want to stay in Europe. They can't stay in Poland, where anti-Semitism persecution persists. And the state of Israel doesn't exist yet, and the British still don't want to allow refugees from Europe to come to Palestine. So what I look at is sort of the options that are available to these survivors and the situation that they face and what ends up being a disproportionately large role that they play in diplomatic decisions taken after the Second World War.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at, you have this relatively small population of displaced persons, going from 50,000 after the war to perhaps 250,000 by 1947. And as, the first year or two after the war goes on and this growing population of displaced persons grows in Germany, the solution to their, statelessness and the refugee situation becomes increasingly urgent. And initially, the British are reluctant to allow these survivors to come to Palestine, but as the number of survivors grows and their sort of demonstrations on behalf of Zionism and the need for the creation of the State of Israel grows, you have this remarkable situation where people who have just been liberated from camps, emerging from hiding, emerging from the Holocaust, come to play a very significant role in international diplomacy after the war, and in many ways leading to the creation of the State of Israel.
Now, there were kibbutzim in Germany and Poland at first. How did these places arise? What were they like?
So it's one of the aspects, it's actually one of the things that drew me to this topic in the first place when I discovered that there were actually operating agricultural training farms that were created in Germany and in Poland very soon after the end of the war. One of the first places that's created is a kibbutz that takes the name Kibbutz Buchenwald, and it's a kibbutz of survivors from the concentration camp of Buchenwald who decided that they couldn't live, in what remained of the concentration camp, and that they wouldn't live in a refugee camp that had been created nearby, and that they wanted to train themselves for their future lives in the land of Israel. And so these survivors who created Kibbutz Buchenwald basically took over what had been a German farm. It was requisitioned through the assistance of the American military and sympathetic GIs and Jewish chaplains with the U.S. Army. And they created a functioning farm. And this model became so successful that by the end of 1946, you have 40 farms like this operating throughout Germany, in the American zone of Germany after the war, housing thousands of young people working on these farms. And in many cases, they were fully operating farms, although the young people working on them often didn't know the first thing about agriculture. So they had to be trained how to be farmers or, often relied on the assistance of Germans who were living nearby to help them farm, who had worked on the farm before. So it's a very unusual situation that emerges in Germany after the war. But much of what happens in Germany in the first 2-3 years after the war is highly unusual. So it's par for the course.
Talk about untold stories. I mean, German farmers helping Holocaust survivors farm in 1946 through 48.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. You know, one of the farms that I write about in the book is a farm that takes the name Kibbutz Nili, which comes from an acronym from the Book of Samuel. Nili stands for Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, or the eternal strength of Israel will not be belied. And the young people who are working on this farm, it's not just any farm, it's the estate of Julius Streicher, who was one of the foremost Nazi propagandists and actually one of the 22 Nazis put on trial at Nuremberg. And so you have to imagine that you have these young people farming his estate, taking over the buildings and working with his animals, renaming everything with Hebrew names, while nearby in Nuremberg, he is on trial and eventually executed. So it's pretty remarkable, and sort of it functions really as kind of a symbolic sort of revenge, also for them to be able to take matters into their own hands and take over this estate over the war. And I think that symbolic significance is very important in these sort of diplomatic decisions that are made after the war, when international powers have to decide, well, what will be done with these survivors and refugees after the war?
The kibbutz model is a combination of a kind of collective socialism and Zionism, and I was wondering if the impulse toward collectivism was, it seems like it must have been a natural response to persecution and genocide. Did that experience of the kibbutz help people to deal with the trauma of the war and the Holocaust?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. One of the things that I try to understand in the book and in my research is what is the appeal of this model for many of the young people who do join these kibbutz groups after the war. And, in some cases, we deal with these, what I described for you as these agricultural farms, and in other cases, a kibbutz is used after the war to refer to sort of these collective units of somewhere between 50 and 100 young people who decide that they're going to live together, to pool their resources, to be part of a youth movement. And one of the things we have to remember is that many of the survivors are young, between the ages of 15 and 30. That's who was most likely to survive. And for many of them, they are orphaned, they're alone, they have no family left after the war. And so this model, sort of an alternative living framework that is collectivist in nature, that can provide a kind of a replacement family, is very appealing after the war. That being said, the sort of ideology that the movements represent and that these kibbutz groups represent isn't necessarily what draws them into these groups. They, you know, often don't know much about the ideology of the movements they're joining. They've spent 6 years in hiding or being persecuted during the war. So it's often more sort of the pragmatic and psychological appeal of these kibbutz groups that draws them in more than, you know, the ideology of the movement that they're joining, which they often know very little about.
There is some historical controversy about the whole question of Zionism and the impulse towards Zionism and whether it arose naturally from the survivors themselves or was more heavily influenced by outside ideologies and organizations. Your book is called Finding Home and Homeland, and you drew on sources like diaries and letters and so on written by the survivors themselves. What did you find? How did your original source material help you flesh out some answers to those questions?
Well, as you allude to, I certainly wrote this book in response to a debate that was going on in the historical literature about Zionism amongst the survivors. You know, there were these sort of two opposing schools of thought. One that said that Zionism after the war, the desire to create a Jewish state, was a very natural and obvious conclusion to what they'd experienced after the war. And then the other school said, you know, that the Zionism was not homegrown among the survivors, but was the survivors themselves were manipulated by emissaries sent from Palestine on behalf of the Zionist movement, who were trying to use the survivors to, you know, in their effort to create the state, and looked at the survivors as sort of weak and passive after the war. And I thought that in order to answer this question, you know, there hadn't really been enough work and research that had looked at materials created by the survivors themselves to say, well, what is it that they truly wanted? Because one of the things that's remarkable about this period in time, 1945 and thereafter in the DP camps, is that there is a remarkable amount of source material created by the survivors themselves. As you allude to, there are diaries, there are letters, there are newspapers. It's a tremendously productive period of time, and so there is more than enough material to try to understand what is it the survivors saw amongst themselves. And what becomes apparent is that Zionism was most definitely a conclusion that was reached by the survivors, not something that was imposed from abroad. But as I suggest, it had an appeal that oftentimes was more pragmatic and psychological than ideological, that for the young people that I write about, the appeal that drew them into these kibbutz groups was more about, as I say in my title, sort of the quest, the looking for a home, something that would give them that sense of camaraderie and what had been lost during the war. Once they had joined these sort of alternative homes, they did become educated in the ideology of the movement. But it was a process that began first with sort of that search for looking for a home after the war, that then ultimately led them to the State of Israel.
Avinoam Pat is a professor of modern Jewish history at the Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Hartford. And once again, he will be speaking on Sunday, the 2nd of January, at Congregation Beit Tikva, sponsored by the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society. The talk is called Jewish Youth and Zionism in the Aftermath of the Holocaust. And his book is called Finding Home and Homeland. Thank you so much, Professor Pat, for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And by the way, I'm doing a little survey at facebook.com/radiocafe. So check it out. Give your opinions about the Santa Fe Radio Cafe at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.